Hello and welcome to Homestead Hens and Honey, a beekeeping, chicken keeping, and general homesteading podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and today I'm bringing you a special mini episode on bees in the news. Previously, I had said that I really wanted to get an episode up this week about Higgins, my Russian tortoise, where I was going to go over some tortoise facts and some funny stories about my little guy. I am preparing to do some traveling, and I couldn't get the time to really give that episode what it deserved in terms of research. Tortoises are just so cool. I really didn't want to do them dirty by not really packing that episode with a lot of information. So instead, I thought what I would do is I would go through my folder where I store news articles and scientific publications all about bees. Honeybees, native pollinators, bumblebees, things like that. So some of you might have noticed an increase of honeybees popping up in the news. Some of it has been sort of a focus again on food sources for us, since honeybees are such prolific pollinators, and they're particularly important to things like the almond growing industry in California, which is the largest almond growing industry in the world. But bees have also been the subject of scientific research for a while, and they seem to be picking up increasing interest within the biology community as an animal that really provides a lot of options to study. So my husband, as a biologist, he's not studying insects or honeybees, sadly. He's much more of a reptile guy, but he gets access to all these different articles, and every time a bee is mentioned, he sends them to me. And because I talk about bees constantly, all my family and friends, if they see an article in the news about honeybees in particular, they will email that to me as well. So I have a folder in my email where I store all of that information. And I thought that today it might be fun to just go through some of those articles that really caught my eye and I thought would be of interest to all of you. So with that said, I wanted to just do a really quick update about things here on the homestead. We had some days where the nights were cold, but the days were mild. There's been a noticeable increase in songbirds in the garden, and we had quite a lot of rain. Now, here in Northeast Ohio, when spring is on the way, it rains a lot. It rains so much, in fact, that my garden will flood. And usually when my garden starts flooding is a good indication of how quickly spring is arriving. And since my garden flooded twice, and we had daffodils poking up, and the increase in the songbirds, I really thought that we were going to maybe have an early spring. And then last week it started snowing. And as I record this, I am looking out on a garden covered in snow. So I am feeling very demoralized by this. I was so looking forward to being able to spend a bit more time outside, and you know, I know better than to get my hopes up for early spring, but somehow Ohio tricks me every year. So from this snowy, terrible, wintry world, I'm recording this podcast for you with some stuff, some news, some studies that I think they cheered me up, so let's hope that they can do the same for you as well. Now, before I dive into the articles I have selected, I wanted to give a really quick overview of how publication works in the scientific field, what you need to know about it, and how you can access this information for free. So firstly, every scientific publication requires a paid subscription to read the full paper. And it's important to know that absolutely $0 of this goes towards the authors. It is entirely for the publishing company. Early on in science, having papers published was the best way to share information. And as a result, it was also seen as your contribution to your field. So within academia, there are structures in place of things that you work towards, such as if you're in a tenure track position, and a certain amount of publications can be part of what you need to do in order to meet the standards required at your institution to achieve tenure. And it's the same for a number of awards and other things like that in academia. They want to see a certain amount of papers published, and the better the publication, the more it's held in higher regard, the more impact those papers can have on your career. So it's absolutely essential that scientists do contribute and have papers published. The problem then is that when publications realize that they are an essential part of the academic's career, and they realize that they could charge more and more, instead of just charging fees to cover like servers for the websites or for the actual printing if they do have a hard copy, they charge literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to have access to this various amount of work produced by other people. So if you're an institution, in order to have access to an entire publication's worth of information, that's where you're looking at paying hundreds of thousands of dollars. For an individual, if you wanted access to a certain publication, you're looking at more like a couple of hundred dollars a year in order to have access to those papers. And accessing papers is important, particularly if you're a student. And if you're a student and you live somewhere in the world where universities are very poorly funded and don't have a lot of money available, you can't access those papers because your institution cannot afford to pay for the subscription, and neither can you because you live somewhere where a couple of hundred dollars a year is just asking the impossible. Now, as a result, there are ways that students and the general public like you and I can access these papers for free. So the easiest way to do that is if you search for the lead author's name. So that's the first author's name that pops up on the paper. If you search their author's name, you will often find their website, which is usually through their institution that they work at or worked at if they're retired. And most authors will have all of their papers available for free on their personal website. If you do a Google search and nothing is coming up for the author in terms of a list of their publications, like say that they have a website, but they don't have the papers available on the website, they will have an email them and just politely ask if they can send you a copy. In the vast majority, like 99.9% of the time, they will be delighted that you have asked to read their work and they will happily send it to you. Another option is a website called SciHub. And I'll have this linked in my episode description. I'll also have links to all of the articles and papers discussed today, so you can go through and read them. So SciHub, which is sci-hub.se, is an interesting place. It's where papers, academic papers, can be uploaded so that anyone can read them for free. It's basically a form of piracy for academic papers, but don't get the wrong idea. It's often very supported by academics. They want their work to be available and affordable for people, if not free. It's a workaround, and it might not live forever. I'm sure that the many publication companies, if they can figure out who runs it, will sue them into oblivion. But for now, we have it as an option. And so you can go to that website, you can put in the author's name or the title of the article, and if they have it, it will be available there for free. So those are your options. So Google the author, check their website. If their website doesn't have the papers, send them a polite email. They will often send it to you directly. And if all else fails, go to sci-hub.se and see if they have it uploaded. Okay, so the first one that I wanted to talk about is something that's been in the news a lot lately. And you might have seen the headlines like new vaccine for honeybees, It's Like Magic was a tagline that was put up a lot. I have chosen to reference and link the CBS News article and a article from the Smithsonian. CBS News, because they have a really great video of someone working a hive and an interview about sort of benefits of this vaccine. So I thought that would be good for anyone who wants to see that. And then the Smithsonian's article is just slightly more detailed and it gives a little bit more information about the vaccine itself. So what's going on here? What is this vaccine? Well, the vaccine is for inoculation against American fowl brood. And this is a nasty bacterial disease that spreads through spores and is highly infectious. And it's named fowl brood because it particularly targets the brood in a hive and often will be aware that we have this issue because we'll go into the hive and the brood will be this disgusting, gross, dark, foul-smelling mess. Historically, the only treatment has been antibiotics, but these are expensive, they're hard to source for the average beekeeper, application can be a challenge, and they're not even effective most of the time. So for most people, if you get a confirmed diagnosis of American fowl brood, you would need to euthanize the colony and then burn all equipment that came into contact in order to prevent transmission. So being diagnosed, if even just one of your colonies with American fowl brood, is absolutely devastating. And it's one of those things as a beekeeper that I'm afraid of and try not to think about and hope that I never have to encounter. Now, the interesting thing about this vaccine is that insects generally, you know, as a whole, insects don't produce antibodies. That's not the way their body functions. So attempting to create vaccines for them had never really looked like a promising area of study for a lot of people. But this one company, Dallan Animal Health, had been looking into the concept and they had developed this vaccine for American fowl brood, and it was recently approved by the USDA. And that's why it's in the news right now, because once it's been approved for use, that's a really big deal. So I'm just going to quote directly from the Smithsonian article here, because I feel like they really covered things very well. So beekeepers will mix the vaccine, which contains dead P. larva, which is the American fowl brood bacteria cells, into the food that worker bees eat. Then, when the worker bees secrete their milky royal jelly, the queen will ingest it and the vaccine. From there, the vaccine will make its way to her ovaries, where it will immunize developing larvae. According to the company, the vaccine is not genetically modified and it can be used in organic farming. Under a conditional license from the USDA, Dallan Animal Health now plans to distribute limited amounts of the vaccine to commercial beekeepers. From there, they hope to offer it for sale throughout the US sometime this year. So that's very exciting. And if you're anything like me, your friends and family and people who've met you once have all sent you some kind of news article about this. I am going to include an extra link on my blog and in the episode description, from Reddit. So Reddit, someone posted on Uplifting News this article about the first vaccine for honeybees, and the comments are really funny. There are people, there's a lot of puns and wordplay. There's a lot of talking about how tiny will the needle have to be to inject the bees and all this kind of silly stuff. It's just a fun read, so I wanted to include it. Okay, so next up, this is a paper in Science, and Science is one of the biggest publications for scientists. So it's a really, really big deal if you can have a paper published with them. And the title of this paper is Social Signal Learning of the Waggle Dance in Honeybees. And it's by Shihao Dong, Tao Lin, James C. Ni, and Ken Tan. And I apologize if I butchered any of those names. So again, I'm just going to quote directly from the paper because this is a very good summary about, you know, what it's about. So to quote, The honeybee waggle dance has long been recognized as a behavior that communicates information about resource location from a foraging worker to her nestmates. Dong et al. Show that this complex dance is in part learned by young bees as they observe more experienced bees. Specifically, bees that were not exposed to the dances of their older counterparts displayed more angle and distance errors than those who had had a tutor. Although experience increased angle and direction accuracy, untutored bees were never able to recover accurate distance coding. Thus, as with birds, humans, and other social learning species, honeybees benefit from observing others of their kind that have experience. So this one caught my eye because A, who doesn't love the waggle dance? I love that they communicate with dancing. I love to watch my bees do it. It's fascinating. And B, I really thought it was interesting in the latter part of that quote about how bees can gain experience and that will help them with really learning how to spread that information, to share what they've discovered back at the hive. But if they were untutored during their younger years, if they didn't have access to watching older bees perform the waggle dances, they were never able to recover that accurate distance coding. And that's interesting to me because we know that, particularly in birds and mammals, that there is a period of time where the offspring has essential learning. So it's where, for instance, with human babies, I really wanted to say human larva then, but I don't want to offend anyone. Human babies, not larva. Human babies. There have been experiments done previously, I mean, a long time ago before, you know, ethics was a concern, where, you know, babies were left where they would have very minimal physical contact, almost no visual stimulus. People didn't talk to them, things like that, to see how it affected brain development. And the brain just fails to develop without that stimulus. And we know that, for instance, there are key periods of your childhood where you learn certain things, from motor skills to increasing your visual acuity to language acquisition. And so I find it fascinating that an insect species is showing something similar, that if they don't have access to information within a certain age frame, then even gaining experience as an adult isn't going to breach that gap. So that's why I chose this particular article. Okay, so the next one that I thought I would share is in the Journal of Integrative and Comparative Biology. And the title of the paper is The Impacts of Early Life Experience in Bee Phenotypes and Fitness. And the authors are Claire C. Ritzkoff and Amanda S. Denny. I'm going to read the abstract from the paper here. So to quote, across diverse animal species, early life experiences have lifelong impacts on a variety of traits. The scope of these impacts, their implications, and the mechanisms that drive these effects are central research foci for a variety of disciplines in biology, from ecology and evolution to molecular biology and neuroscience. Here, we review the role of early life in shaping adult phenotypes and fitness in bees, emphasizing the possibility that bees are ideal species to investigate the causes and consequences of variation in early life experience at both individual and population levels. Bee early life includes the larval and pupal stages, critical time periods during which factors like food availability, maternal care, and temperature set the phenotypic trajectory for an individual's lifetime. We discuss how some common traits impacted by these experiences, including developmental rate and adult body size, influence fitness at the individual level, with possible ramifications at the population level. Finally, we review ways in which human alterations to the landscape may impact bee population through early life effects. This review highlights aspects of bees' natural history and behavioural ecology that warrant further investigation, with the goal of developing a better understanding of the ways in which environmental disturbances threaten these vulnerable species. Okay, so I apologise for stumbling a little bit. But basically, you might be able to see why I chose this one, and it's because, again, we're looking at early life experiences. So I thought it was a good follow-up from the previous paper. And this one I like as well because it's extracting what they know or what they are discovering about these early life experiences and our connection, like how we're affecting the ecosystem in a way that directly impacts these early life effects on bees. And this paper is basically arguing that this is an ideal species that deserves further research and study based on what they already know about how these early life experiences affect the colony and how the landscape around them directly impacts these early life experiences. So I thought it was interesting. I also really like this journal, the Journal of Integrative and Comparative Biology. It's one that I'm familiar with through my husband's work. I think it has a lot of very interesting papers that it tends to share. So I really wanted to highlight this one. And again, the link will be in the episode description and on my website. Next up, I have a paper that was published in Animal Behaviour, and the title is Honeybee Waggle Dances Facilitate Shorter Foraging Distances and Increase Foraging Aggregation. The authors are Kyle Shackleton, Nicholas J. Balfour, Hassan Al-Tufailia, Emma James, Francis R.W. Ratniex, and these people are all from the University of Sussex in Brighton, England. So I wanted to put that in there. Go team. And again, I'm going to quote directly from the paper here. Many social organisms assist their group mates in foraging. The honeybee waggle dance allows nestmates to communicate the locations of rewarding flower patches. This remarkable behaviour can increase colony food collection under certain environmental conditions. However, we know little about how it affects colony foraging distribution in the landscape. Here, we predicted that dance communication influences foraging distances and increases the aggregation of foraging locations. We tested these predictions by manipulating the ability of Apis mellifera colonies situated in a heterogeneous landscape to communicate location information. Following established methodology, six study colonies in observation hives were turned horizontally and exposed to light treatments that produced either oriented or disoriented dancing. After 10 to 17 days, hives were then turned vertically and allowed to dance under normal conditions. We videoed and decoded dances to compare foraging patterns that had developed during the preceding treatment. This procedure was repeated throughout the foraging season from spring to autumn. Dance decoding revealed that, on average, bees from disoriented colonies recruited for food sources further away than the oriented colonies. This effect was consistent throughout the year. Oriented colonies' recruitment was to a smaller area and was more spatially aggregated than that of disoriented colonies. However, experimental treatment did not affect colony weight gain. Our results show that dance communication plays an important role in the spatial distribution of foraging and is potentially beneficial in reducing commuting costs by directing recruits to closer foraging locations. These findings may be particularly relevant in heterogeneous landscapes. Okay, so firstly, heterogeneous is just a fancy word for varied, so varied landscapes. And I wanted to include this because it harkens back to the waggle dance that was mentioned in a previous paper. And I thought this was an interesting experiment, how they used different orientation of the hives, which subjected them to different light patterns in order to orient or disorient a colony. I thought that was very clever and also kind of easy to visualize. And conveniently, the abstract for this paper includes a highlight of things that were found. So the highlights were: the honeybee waggle dance enables recruitment to smaller foraging areas. Colonies unable to communicate dance information foraged farther from their hives. The waggle dance is potentially beneficial in reducing commuting costs. And these findings might be particularly relevant in heterogeneous or varied landscapes. So I thought this was interesting. So particularly them saying that the colony weight gain wasn't affected. So even when they had disoriented a colony and those workers were traveling much further in order to source food, they were not suffering a slow or overall decreased weight gain. So they were still finding an equal amount of food as the oriented hives. That's very interesting to me, and I hope that they'll dig a little deeper into that in future experiments. So that's kind of it for that one. Let's see. Okay, so my last one, this is another one that you might have seen in the news a little while ago. It was again in the Journal of Animal Behavior, and it's titled "Do Bumblebees Play?" And the authors are Hiruni Samadi, Gelbeyaje Dona, Sin Solvi, Amelia Kolowski, Carla Makali, Hadi Mabudi, and Lars Chitka. And again, I am so sorry about my pronunciations there. This was a collaborative project. It was between three institutions, so it included the Queen Mary University of London in England, the University of Oulu in Finland, and the University of Sheffield, again in England. And to quote directly from the paper, "A variety of animals have been found to interact with and manipulate inanimate objects just for fun, that is, to play. Most clear examples of object play come from mammals and birds. However, whether insects interact with inanimate objects as a form of play has never been systematically examined. Here, we show that rolling of wooden balls by bumblebees, Bombus terrestris, fulfills behavioural criteria for animal play and is akin to play in other animals. We found that ball rolling, 1, did not contribute to immediate survival strategies, 2, was intrinsically rewarding, 3, differed from functional behaviour in form, 4, was repeated but not stereotyped, and 5, was initiated under stress-free conditions. Through the design of the experiment and with the support of behavioural observations, we excluded the possibilities that ball rolling was driven by exploration for food, clutter clearing, or mating. Similar to vertebrate play, we also found age and sex differences for ball rolling by bumblebees. Younger bees rolled more balls than older bees, and male bees rolled individual balls for longer durations than females. We explicitly show that ball rolling is itself a rewarding activity. After being trained to find freely movable balls in one of two differently coloured chambers, bees showed a preference for the colour of the chamber where they had rolled balls. Our results contribute to the question of sentience in insects and lend further support for the existence of positive affective states in these animals." And to just hit the highlights there, ball rolling by bumblebees fulfills animal play criteria. Ball rolling can act as an unconditioned rewarding stimulus. Younger bees rolled more balls with age patterns resembling mammalian juvenile play. Males rolled balls for longer durations than females. Okay, so this one was in the news and a lot of people were charmed by it, as am I. And that's why I wanted to include it. But I really wanted to include it because when I saw the news headlines popping up about, you know, do bumblebees play? Yes. My first thought was, is this something that stems from a survival behavior? So my thing was, from rolling up pollen to give to the offspring, for instance, in their colonies. But this experiment is way ahead of me, and they hit all those points. So they're saying that it didn't involve, or at least it didn't appear to contribute to immediate survival strategies, of which I think pollen rolling, because it's a food source, would be one. That just the act of playing was itself the reward for the bees. There was no sort of conditioning required to get them to start playing with these little wooden balls. Again, it's not a functional behavior. So my idea that maybe, you know, this is the best way to roll pollen for babies, that's out. And also that it occurred under stress-free conditions. So only when there was a lack of pressure and stress were the bees engaging in play. And the fact that juvenile bees seem to engage for longer and more often than older bees is very much like what we see in, you know, mammals and birds. The babies tend to be more playful than the adults. And I also thought it was interesting that the male bees would roll individual balls for longer than the females would. I have no idea why that would be the case, but I hope that they will dig into that a little bit, because I would really like to learn more. So this is a very interesting one, in part because the idea of intelligence in animals is still very hotly debated. And things like trying to assess, you know, pleasure, even pain in other animals can be very difficult. And particularly in insects, when you're looking at something that doesn't have a spinal column, it has a completely different nervous system, it's hard for us to be able to say, you know, this is pleasure, this isn't, you know, this is for fun, this isn't. And I find it particularly interesting that we are turning our attention to insects now to try and figure out what things they share with vertebrates. So I really, really like this one. It's a very interesting read. I will have the link available for everyone. And remember what I said at the beginning, if you can't access a paper through the links that I provide, you can contact the author and either request the paper, or they might have it already on their website. Before I go, since I ended this on a paper about bumblebees, I wanted to remind anyone who's in North America, so the US and Canada, about Bumblebee Watch. So the website is bumblebeewatch.org, and I'm just going to read from their website here because they sum things up really nicely. Bumblebee Watch is a collaborative effort to track and conserve North America's bumblebees. This community science project allows for individuals to upload photos of bumblebees to start a virtual bumblebee collection, identify the bumblebees in your photos and have your identifications verified by experts, help researchers determine the status and conservation needs of bumblebees, help locate rare or endangered populations of bumblebees, learn about bumblebees, their ecology and ongoing conservation efforts, and connect with other community scientists. It's really, really easy to get involved with this. So all you need to do is you go to their website, you create an account, and it's a very easy process. And then you just go out and you start looking for bumblebees. And ideally what happens is you snap a picture of them, you make a note of the location, and then you go to the website and you upload that. So it's really easy to do. You know, I think almost everyone in the world now, apart from my mother-in-law, has a smartphone. So we all have access to a camera. So if you're gardening, if you're on a walk and you happen to spot a bumblebee, grab a picture if you can, make a quick note about where you are, and then contribute to this really awesome project. This citizen science project is supported by really cool organizations like the Xerxes Society, which I'm a huge fan of, Wildlife Preservation Canada, and even the London Natural History Museum, among a couple of others. So it's, you know, it's a very well done, well supported program, and it needs as many people as possible getting those pictures, getting that information and submitting it. And it's also a great way for you to connect with other community scientists. So other people in your communities who really care about bumblebees and pollinators and want to be involved. And that's what I have for you this week. It was a challenge choosing articles. I have so many, and there's been a really big influx recently of exciting research being done, particularly on honeybees, but there's also some on native US pollinators. I feel like at every convention that my husband attends, there are at least two talks or papers on honeybees. So it's been very exciting. I did want to include one about honeybee tongues, but it was very technical and I wanted to keep this short, but I think it's something that I'll pick up again in future. And I'll do one of these episodes again where I can just sort of share all of these interesting studies. So once again, if you have any questions about anything that I discussed today, you can comment on my website. You can email me at homesteadhensandhoney@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment actually on the podcast episode. And anything that I can't answer, I will have my biologist husband look at. And if we can't answer it together, maybe we can offer you a resource that can. So as a heads up, for the next 2 weeks, there will be no episodes as I'm going to be traveling. When I return, I will have my Russian tortoise episode all ready to go. So I hope you'll be ready to learn about these fascinating shelled critters, one of which I'm very fortunate to share my life with. Higgins is a real character. I just love him. And he looks like a little dinosaur that lives in my house. It's just fantastic. So I'm excited to share that with you. And once again, that will be after 2 weeks of absence so that I can travel and then get back and get sorted and all that good stuff. So until then, I hope you're all staying safe and healthy and happy. And as always, remember, hug your hens and then wash your hands. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.